The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Catherine G. Leonard, the Honorable Sonia M. P. McCullen, the Honorable Kimberly T. Guidry presiding. Enoho ilalo. Please be seated. Calling case number CAAP-22-405, plaintiff appellant, State of Hawaii versus defendant appellee, Kaimi Skepiapo, arguing for the appellant, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, Renee Ishikawa DeLizzo, arguing for the appellee, Deputy Public Defender, Seth Paddock, argument on the merits.
Good morning. Counsel, would you please state your appearances for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. Renee Ishikawa DeLizzo, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, appearing for the State of Hawaii.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Public Defender, Seth Paddock, on behalf of Kaimi Skepiapo.
Thank you. I understand you would like to save 10 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. All right. Would you like to proceed at the podium?
It was not the same episode. The offenses in the underlying case and the offenses in the family court case did not arise from the same episode. Element 1 of HRS section 701-109 subparent 2 was not met, therefore compulsory joinder was not required. The three elements of this statute are conjunctive, so if one element is missing, there is no compulsory joinder required. First, the trial court in the underlying case erred in its determination of the three sub-elements for same episode. The three sub-elements of the same episode test are also conjunctive. All three sub-elements must exist for there to be the same episode. The sub-element C in the underlying case, the circumstances factor, was not met. The Supreme Court case of State versus Sardinha clarified that sub-element C requires a significant overlap of factual and or legal issues of the offenses. Also, Sardinha clarified that the presence and absence of probable cause is not dispositive in determining whether there is a close relationship in circumstances.
Counsel, we recognize it's not dispositive, but it wasn't wrong for the circuit court to consider it, was it?
It was not wrong for it to consider probable cause, but in two ways it erred. First of all, it looked at probable cause at the end of the detective's police report, at the end of the police investigation, when it should have looked at probable cause at the point in time of initial arrest of appellee, which I will probably say defendant in this hearing, just out of my common practice. But the initial arrest for defendant was only for the terroristic threatening, the reckless endangering, and place to keep. He was not arrested for the abuse offenses until much later at the police station. So the point of initial arrest, there was no probable cause for the abuse offenses. This is where majorly a trial court erred. And Carroll and Cervantes support our position that the point of initial arrest is controlling. Also, the trial court erred because its focus on probable cause took over its whole analysis of the same episode, of the sub-elements for the same episode. It almost seemed that
The circuit court did consider, in looking at circumstances, though, the overlapping factual, the overlapping facts, right? In the sense that the circuit court did point out that the key witnesses in both cases are largely the same. So there is there not overlapping, substantial overlapping facts with respect to both the abuse charges and the firearms charges?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, we would say that there was no substantive overlap of material facts. And looking at the Sardinha analysis, They stated that the inquiry is whether the prosecution can fairly put on a complete case without reference to the other offense.
Counsel, could I just to clarify, though, at least with the domestic the abuse charges and the terroristic threatening, it appears that the complaining witness for both charges is the same. So I guess my question would be, how could a complete case be put on to try both of those charges without the same evidence and the same facts? Because it appears that they're tied together. There's an underlying common factual, underlying common facts and evidence.
The underlying common fact of the complainant being the same victim in both three offenses that you referred to, and that is not controlling.
So, Ms. Ishikawa-DeLuzzo, let me ask you to look at it a little differently, maybe. Stepping back, what we have here is an episode in the evening that started, you know, well, he's been charged and convicted and sentenced. So we can say, okay, there was an episode of domestic abuse, right, in the evening. It continued in the morning. There was another episode, right? But it's all part of the same. Stepping back and just looking at this as what happened between these people, that's why those were charged in the family court case, right? And so on the morning of the 18th, you have the shove, right? And then he leaves, gets in the car, and you have the call or whatever it is on the road, I've got a gun. Doesn't that feel like part of the same escalating episode of domestic violence? I mean, rather than picking on just the tiny little subphrases that support your position, I mean, that's why we're struggling with this, because it does seem like this is an episode of abuse and domestic violence, at least with respect to, you know, the event in the evening before, at home in the morning, and then the phone call, the allegation of terroristic threatening one. And I'll stop there and let you address that.
Well, defendant's anger doesn't make it a same episode.
No, but isn't it a factual part of the story, the complete accounting? Doesn't it share that?
No, first of all, when we went to grand jury to present the case, there was no testimony about the abuses having happened. So it shows that the prosecution could present its case fairly without reference to the abuse offenses. Second of all, there was a line of demarcation that you referred to. The defendant left after the second abuse. He went to Rice Park in Kula to cool off. He was there about 30 minutes. And then considering the travel time from the Kumano Place Drive house in Makawao to Rice Park in Kula, that's about 14 minutes away. It's about 7.5 miles away. So the travel time, when you add that to the 30 minutes, there's a good one hour period of separation before the phone call, possibly at minimum. Could have been longer if the phone call wasn't immediately when he arrived back at his residence. So that period of time is the point that separates the abuses from the terroristic threatening offense. And the terroristic threatening offense, when he verbalized that he was going to kill her after he got back to the house, and that he had a loaded firearm, that did not become fully realized until he arrived at the grandmother's house in Paia. And again, Paia is Makai, and Makawao is Mauka. And they're about 19 minutes travel time at the shortest apart. They're two different cities. So that is why we have viewed the abuses separate, as occurring separate from the point of time of the terroristic threatening and the reckless endangering and the firearm offenses. They're separate locations, they occurred at separate time, and the circumstances, the material facts for the abuse offenses involve hitting her in the forehead with the keys for the first count, the second count grabbing her by the arms and shoving her against the wall that caused both times caused her injury. And then in the underlying case, a terroristic threatening was a verbal threat, but there was no injury. There was no element of physical injury that was required. And Lessery, although it involved double jeopardy, the Hawaii Supreme Court in that case stated that the conduct element of abuse is different from the conduct element of terroristic threatening. So both in the elements of the charges and the material facts, sub-element C for the circumstances factor was not met. So the same episode did not occur.
So you're saying you can try the defendant for the terroristic threatening and you're not, and you can tell the complete account and not raise the issue of domestic abuse?
Yes. He was upset and called the complainant on the phone threatening to kill her because she was gone. She was not present with the kids at the house when he got back from the park. He didn't say because he didn't mention having committed the abuses. Of course he wouldn't, but there's no material fact that connects them besides the anger that he had for the complainant. We argue that is not material to an analysis of material facts or legal issues of the offenses. And so the trial court's focus on probable cause and also the differing circumstances, as pointed out by Sardina, shows us clearly that sub-element C, the circumstances factor of same episode under Carroll, is not satisfied. And as I have argued, the places were different, so sub-element B of the Carroll test was not met, and the time, sub-element A, was not met. The trial court erred in its finding of conclusion of law 6, because the trial court only looked at count 2 of the abuse occurred on the same day as the terroristic threatening. It did not consider count 1.
Counsel, did you challenge conclusion of law 6 in your briefing?
No, we didn't challenge that because
that
was correct. The trial court did consider only count 2. So we did not challenge it.
Okay.
But that shows us that the trial court did not consider offense number 1 that happened the day before. Also in conclusion of law 7, the trial court considered that, implicitly considered that the offenses occurred at different places because it stated that the conduct started at one location and moved to another. Well, that already shows us that the locations were not the same.
Okay, but that is not challenged either. Conclusions of law 10, 11, 13, and 14 are the only ones that are challenged on this appeal. Isn't that correct?
Yes, because that is correctly stating what the trial court's analysis was.
Okay, well, I want to ask you about another count. What evidence is necessary to prosecute the carrying, possessing loaded firearm on the public highway? How do you develop that? Who's the witness? Who testifies to that?
That would be Mr. Nishioka, who confronted defendant when he arrived at the Paia house. So it involves a different complainant.
Right, so the complaining witness from the domestic abuse doesn't need to testify or won't be called to testify as to him carrying a gun on the road?
Correct.
Okay.
She would only be able to say, according to the police report, that on the phone, he said he was bringing a loaded rifle. That's the extent to what possibly the evidence that she could say.
Well, but that's part of her arguably part of the domestic abuse escalation, right? That, okay, first he threw keys at me, then he shoved me, then he called on the road, he's bringing a gun.
That would be defendant's analysis, not the state's analysis. The state would just offer that statement or what she heard on the phone as to what was actually said, okay, admission, so, not as to whether it's the same circumstances or not.
Ms. DeLizzo, I want to ask you a question, but it's kind of taking a step back, and I kind of need help with interpreting subsection 2. And I'm going to ask the same of Mr. Patek. When I look at subsection 2 of 701-109, and I look at the plain language, because that's where we start, right, the plain language, it says, a defendant shall not be subject to separate trials. And I'll stop there. In subsection 1, the statute talks about being prosecuted. Subsection 2 talks about being charged. Subsection 4 talks about being convicted. And so when we go back to subsection 2 and the use of the term trials, it seems very intentional. And so is it significant that in this case, the defendant pled no contest and there was never a trial as to the abuse? So I guess my question is, do we even fall under subsection 2?
That is something that, believe it or not, did cross my mind when I was thinking about the case. But we look at Sardinia. Sardinia is the most recent statement of the Hawaii Supreme Court. Defendant pled no contest to the inattention. This was the MVA hit and run. And then later on, he was arguing at a restaurant with his wife, I believe, or significant other. And the police showed up and they realized that the car he was using was the same car involved in the hit and run. Well, the Supreme Court ruled or held that these were separate incidences. They were not compulsory joinder.
So yeah, the Supreme Court just jumped right into the time, place, and circumstance analysis. They never really looked at whether the trial, the language of subsection 2 and the I guess the no contest plea and how those two interact. And then when I go to HRPP Rule 8, 8C talks about failure to join related offenses. And it, for C1, it discusses trials, a first trial, second trial. So it keeps talking about trials. It's not talking about prosecutions or proceedings or anything like that. It's talking about trials. And then subsection 2 really caught my eye because this is what it says. Entry of a plea of guilty or no contest to one offense does not bar the subsequent prosecution of related offenses. So when you read all this together, I am still kind of struggling with, do we even fall? Does this case even fall under subsection 2?
First of all, we would say yes, because Hawaii Supreme Court ruled in Sardinia under the same episode, using the same episode test for 701-109 subparent 2, the element 2 of same episode. So we believe that the Hawaii Supreme Court considered everything in making its holding in Sardinia. As for the HRPP, I note that the HRPP is a slightly variation, a different broader language than 701-109. And the fact that defendant brought their motion under 701-109 is controlling. So the determination by the trial court logically would be based on this statute, not on the HRPP. And that is what we're here today for, the statute and not the HRPP, because they did not bring up the HRPP as a basis for the motion. It's a slightly variation of a different language. I hear you that it talks about maybe the same general category, but that is not the issue today. The issue today is 701-109, and that is what we should focus on, we argue. We argue that the remedy here is to reverse the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and reinstate the underlying case because, again, it's conjunctive elements for the statute, conjunctive elements for same episode. If one element is missing, it's all or nothing. If you have all, then it's compulsory joinder. If one is missing, it's nothing. You don't require compulsory joinder. In the underlying case, it's nothing.
Counsel, just going back to HRS 701-109, the purpose of that statute is to promote judicial efficiency, right, and fairness to the defendant. And in this case, would you agree that the state could have, because it brought the felony, it filed the felony indictment first, that it could have also charged the abuse charges in at that same time in circuit court?
Yes, it could have joined the charges.
So what was was there a specific reason, or was it just discretionary that the state chose to, file the indictment separate, charge the firearms charges separately in circuit court, and then subsequently the abuse charges in family court?
It was a decision made, being that these were separate incidences, not the same episode. And to have joined them together in one indictment or one complaint, defendant would logically argue, supposedly probably later on, that it's prejudice to him to go to trial on the terroristic threatening and the reckless endangering and the firearms and have these abuse offenses also in the same case before the jury. The prejudice element might taint the other case. So logically, it was a good decision to charge it separately. And we argue that we cannot break up the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and affirm some, vacate some, because then we're going to split up the underlying case, which is the same episode. That is not disputed. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the circuit court should be affirmed in this case because it came to the correct result. And whether we look at Acau or Sardinia or any of these other cases, they all really stem from Carroll, which stemmed from the Oregon Boyd case. And they all basically apply the same standard. They apply a certain probable cause in various different ways, but it basically says, is it a single episode? Is everything interrelated based on a complete account of what happened? Can you give a complete account of one charge without getting into the other charge? And in this case, you can't. You can't get into a complete account of either the abuse stuff or the gun stuff without talking about the other.
Well, before you move on, let me ask you, how about the place to keep charges? Why do you have to get into the abuse charges, go forward with place to keep?
So if it's okay, let me very briefly get into what I want to talk about in terms of what an episode is, and then I will just very briefly, and then I will answer that question, because I think the idea of what an episode is material to understanding what I'm about to answer your question,
okay.
If that's all right. I don't have a legal definition of episode, but I want to propose that I think it's important that we all look at what an episode really is. What are we talking about when we talk about an episode? Because if we understand what an episode is, we'll have a better idea of whether facts are an episode or aren't. And what I would propose is that an episode, as we look at it, should really be something along the lines of a series of interrelated facts that have some sort of causal link or connection, and that when taken as a whole, can be used to form a coherent narrative. And that's,
okay, but didn't the Supreme Court already tell us what an episode was in Sardina in these cases? I mean, aren't we absolutely bound by how they described it?
So they, in the short answer is yes, we are bound by what they say. But what I'm talking about is a way to look at what it really means. What are we looking at? Because we can apply, and I think, to be honest, I think the cases that we have all been talking about and some of the ones that were cited to in the briefs don't really paint the clearest picture as to what that is. We've all got the definitions, and here we are, we're still struggling over what it means as applied to these facts. So I agree with you, Your Honor, that is, we are bound to what they say, but I nevertheless think that what I've described encompasses in a more lay understanding way how to look at what exactly the Supreme Court is trying to define. And in Sardinia, they talk about legal and factual interrelation. And I think that's the key in terms of what we're talking about as your question regarding the guns. So when we look at the Carroll factors, the sub-factors, time, place, circumstance, yeah, really what we're talking about is the full accounting, the full story, the full narrative, right, of an episode. The time is, of course, answers the question when, the place answers the question where, and I would propose that circumstance really encompasses the who, the what, the how, and the why. And so if we're going to talk about what happened in the gun case, if we want to talk about the who, the what, the when, and the why, we do need to get into the full picture of the episode. So, for instance, at a trial, in a realistic sense, you wouldn't...
Okay, but doesn't the Supreme Court tell us it doesn't really matter, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, what the defendant wants to do to complete the story? We're really focused on, quote, whether the prosecution can fairly put on a complete case without reference to the other offense, which is why I'm honing in on the place to keep charges, because I just don't see, and I know neither side really wants us to split these up, but it the same episode analysis certainly seems to apply better to some of these charges than others.
Well, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, the way I would characterize sort of conceptually, if count one is linked to count two is more closely linked to count three is more closely linked to count four, how close is count one actually linked to count four? And I don't necessarily think that matters in as much as if they're all linked in one episode, they're all linked, and we don't need to get into sort of a qualitative assessment of how well linked they are, 12%, 46%, whatever percent. If they're linked, they're linked. And I think if the strongest link is between count three and four, but nevertheless count one is still linked to count three, then they're all linked. And we don't need to say, well, it's not a strong enough link. If they're linked, they're linked. It's one episode. And so, for instance, in regard to the gun case, the gun charges, I don't think that it's a reasonable or fair way to say, well, the police came. I mean, in reality, you don't really need anybody other than the police officer that recovered the gun and, you know, somebody to say it's a gun or whatever. But you really don't need anybody else. You could just say, we got a gun, he's guilty. I don't necessarily think that would be a fair trial. I don't necessarily think that would be a complete account of what happened. But if we're strictly looking at sort of who's necessary to prove the specific elements, I think we would have a very, very narrow reading. I mean, it's not clear to me why any, this could be seven trials as far as I'm concerned. It's not clear to me why any of them would be linked at all. I do think that just that in a factual sense, though, I think it's really difficult to separate in terms of how trials would realistically be conducted, to separate the gun stuff from the terroristic threatening and from what underlies it. And to give an example of that, you know, if we're going to talk about threats, we're going to talk about sort of a true threat under Valdivia and Chung and these other cases. The state would have to prove that it's a true threat, that it's capable of being believed under the objective circumstances. I don't think there's any way to do that, for whether we're talking about Nishioka, who is the male relative who came out to intervene, or whether we're talking about Viegas, the girlfriend. I don't think there's any reasonable way to talk about why this threat was believable, why this threat was a true threat, without the prior acts that had happened
before. Well,
wait a minute.
For Nishioka, didn't the defendant fire the gun first?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so I think maybe Mr. Nishioka could have thought it was a true threat based on the firing of the gun.
It's possible. I don't necessarily agree that the record would reflect that that's the threat. I think that that would be the reckless endangering, most likely. I think if we asked, certainly there's a, I think it would be accepted that the threat preceded that. The threat was mostly by word. It's confusing. The terroristic threatening charge is confusing because it's unclear whether it's to the wife or whether it's to Nishioka or to the girlfriend, to Viegas or to Nishioka. And partially it's because the threat count specifically cites to a .22 rifle, which I don't know exactly where in the record that would appear in a trial. I mean, I don't think, I'm getting off topic here, but I do think that the true threat would at trial would necessarily encompass what happened prior, and that's why we know why it's true threat. And it goes even beyond that. I mean, the only reason Hiapo was even at the house is because of what happened before, right? So the only reason he went there is because she went there. The only reason she went there is because what happened prior. She was because of what happened at their house, the abuse things. I don't think that we can give an account of what happened without talking about those. I just don't think it's a complete account. So, I mean, I don't think that the gun charges can be related without understanding why he had a gun, why he was there, why he brandished a gun, or why Nishioka was there to intervene in the first place, right? He was there to intervene based on what he had been told had happened. He had been told by Viegas, maybe directly or maybe indirectly, he's coming, this thing happened before, and, you know, don't let him inside the house, or whatever may have happened, whatever specific facts may have happened. You know, I think that's really the key is the narrative has to flow one step at a time. So the first thing happened, because if we just look at time, I mean, I think the Akau case tells us we can't just say, well, it was 1 hour, 2 hours. There's no, excuse me, there's no black line cutoff point as to time or place or anything like that. And we have to look at the big picture. And the only real way to look at the big picture is to say, how do these facts interrelate? How do these legal issues interrelate? If we don't look at how the facts interrelate, we can't really say whether 1 hour is too long or is not too long.
Well, let me just ask you point blank. Do you concede that a complete account of the place to keep offenses could be related without reference to the details of the other offenses presented in this case?
No, I do not.
Okay.
And the reason is because I don't think that that would be a complete account. I think almost by definition.
It wouldn't be a complete account of the place to keep charges.
That's right.
And maybe you could elaborate on that.
So the place to keep charges allege in effect that a gun was possessed in one of the places you're not supposed to have a gun or in one of the manners in which you're not supposed to have a gun. I think were this to be tried, I think the big question for the jurors would be why? If it was there, why was it there? What was the state of mind? What was the defendant's state of mind? Why
is that necessary though to get into, you know, the facts of the facts or the evidence relating to, you know, abuse or the terroristic threatening? Aren't the place to keep charges separate? In that, you know, it requires proof that he had the gun, right, and the ammunition. So I'm just trying to see
sure.
why evidence that relates to specifically to the abuse or maybe even the terroristic threatening, why that would be necessary to prove the place to keep charges.
Yeah. So, I apologize. I'm not being clear on this. So I do think there's a distinction that can be made between what is factually necessary to prove individual elements versus whether something is factually or legally interrelated, and by extension, whether it's a complete account. So it might be possible to present a fact pattern that only encompasses the specific elements, but I don't think that that's would be a complete account. I don't think that that would be how any realistic trial would ever be presented. And I don't think that that would satisfy the Carroll test or the Sardinia test, because its factual and legal interrelation isn't strictly just what the evidence is. This kind of goes to what some of the discussion had been about the procedural nature of 701-109, which is 701-109 to me imposes a duty on the state to charge a certain way, but then leaves the door open down the line to figure out what are the exact evidence, what are the exact charges that belong together. But that determination is step two. And step one, the prerequisite is you got to bring everything together, and then we as a group can decide with one judge, with one set of lawyers, what needs to be brought together and what's separate.
Yeah, but even if I personally would tend to agree that a fair definition of same episode would step back and look at all that together, that's not really what the Supreme Court tells us in Sardinia, is it? I mean, they say first, when they separated out the traffic offense from the assault offense there, they said there's no overlap between the legal issues presented by the traffic offense and the legal issues presented by the assault offense. Clearly, the legal issues on place to keep, there's no overlap with some of these other charges. I mean, other than there's a common element of a gun, arguably, but not with the domestic abuse case.
Well,
go ahead. No,
I just wanted to take one slight exception with that. I think there is a legal interrelation in that
But interrelation is your word. It's not, they say overlap, not, they don't have to be related. I mean, go ahead.
I can change it to overlap, but I think there is a legal overlap in as much as a possession type case necessarily legally has to be established to be a valid recovery or a valid seizure. And so the search, the seizure, the police coming in the first place all stemmed from the allegations that had been made regarding the terroristic threatening, which all stemmed from the allegations or from the actions of the abuse incidents. So for instance, to survive even a motion to suppress the recovery of the gun, legally, the court would have to have findings related to what happened leading up to the report of and the recovery of the gun. So I don't think legally the case could ever go to trial without some reference and without some findings related to the facts that gave rise to the recovery of the gun in the first place. So I think there is a legal overlap. I think that in a possession case, the seizure may be the most important single legal question. So, I mean, so I do think that there are strong legal, I do agree that in some cases or in some counts, the facts overlap and the legal stuff doesn't. And in other areas, the legal stuff overlaps and the facts don't. But I do think in this case, because everything is so connected in a causal way, right? Number one action leads to number two, number two action leads to number three. I think it's really difficult to separate those out. And if we were to just excise the terroristic threatening, I don't think that changes the underlying nature of the episode in any real way. In the same way that, well, I guess what I'm saying is what happened, and whether they charged terroristic threatening against Nishioka or terroristic threatening against Villegas or terroristic threatening against both, I don't know if that's material. I think that the episode is still the episode and everything is still interrelated in that sense. I did want to address your question, Your Honor, regarding 701-109, which I touched on a little bit. I do think that subsection 2 applies here. I think, as I kind of alluded to earlier, I think in order to make a determination of whether it applies, the rule is laid out in a linear fashion. You charge everything together, you get the judge, you get the defense attorney, you get the prosecutor, you get the defendant all in a room, we figure out what is being alleged, and then the judge can make a determination as to what should be severed or what should stay together. The prerequisites of how we charge are separate and apart from the way that we do trials. And I think we'd all agree that sort of the evidence that's presented at trials is almost always a heavily curated version of the offense. But that's separate and apart from what needs to be brought together. And if the court with all the information can make a determination that these two charges, again, subsection 2 says at the request of the prosecutor or the defendant, so anybody can request it, and anybody can request severance if it needs to be done that
that's
way.
That's not subsection 2, though, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I misspeaking?
Subsection. Going back to subsection 2 and the purpose behind it, the policy reason behind it, and the commentary on the case law says basically so that the defendants should not normally have to face the expense and uncertainty of two trials based on essentially the same episode. So again, it's going back to two trials. And once defendant pleads no contest, and then, you know, that's there's no trial there. There's no risk of having two trials. And so how, again, do we fall under subsection two?
Wouldn't he have been subject to two trials to begin with, though?
Well, he definitely was subject to two trials. I mean, it's an interesting reading of it. I think that once you plead, maybe you are no longer subject to two trials. I mean, certainly you were. I guess the question would be, my initial response would still be the violation occurs, the rule is violated when the charges are brought. And once that's done, that's a violation. And so the fact that the defendant may choose to plead to one for whatever reason, I don't think materially changes the obligations for charging to the state.
And so when Rule 8 talks about joinder or failure to join related offenses, how does that subsection 2 play into the analysis where it says entry of a plea of guilty or no contest to one offense does not bar the subsequent prosecution of a related offense?
So, I, again, without really having dug into this issue in depth, my instinct is that relates to if all the cases are properly brought within one charge or one case number, but there are multiple offenses, then you cannot plead to count one and say, I pled to count one, now it's double jeopardy or whatever for count 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. But again, I would propose that contemplates that the charges are brought in compliance with the law as a prerequisite to even getting to that point. If the charges are not brought in compliance with the law, I'm not sure why any of these rules would somehow save that or remedy that.
It goes specifically to failure to join related offenses. I mean, that's what the rule discusses.
I believe that I, again, without
that's
having
what
done,
you're, that's what you're alleging happened here. The prosecution failed to join these offenses.
Right.
The domestic violence with the place to keep or the gun and the TT1, and so it seems to me like Section C2 would apply to what you're asking us to review.
I mean, like I said, I'm a little bit at a disadvantage. I haven't briefed or thought about this particular issue, but I still think, I mean, I think if we're talking about that, we're saying if the state did violate 701-109 in the charging, are they somehow saved, or is the defendant without a remedy, or at least without the remedy that was requested and granted in this case based on that rule? I don't think so. I don't think that is much of a remedy at all. I think that
doesn't that kind of help with the gamesmanship part of it, you know, running and pleading out on the misdemeanors and then going to the felony side and saying,
well,
you can't charge me on this. You have to dismiss it because you should have brought it all together.
I mean, I don't know if I'd use the word help, but from my perspective, I think it might hurt. But if the goal is to keep the charges and not let him get away with it, then I suppose you know, the state might say it helps, but I don't think that's the right way to look at the rule. I think, I think the focus is if a burden is imposed on the state to charge in a manner and they don't charge in that manner, I hesitate to say, well, we should find ways to excuse that failure to follow the rules, right? What I think what you're describing to me pre-assumes that 701-109 wasn't obeyed, but maybe the state can get away with it, or maybe we don't want to give the defendant the remedy that he wants. I don't know if my instinct is that we should not look at violations of the law and how we avoid giving the defendant the remedy he wants. I mean, obviously I'm the defense attorney, of course I'm going to say that. But I think that if we're saying that 109 was violated, then, you know, the secondary question is what is the right outcome in terms of what is the sanction for violating that rule. I don't think there's anything wrong with what the circuit court did. I certainly don't think there's a legal basis to say that it's not allowed. Even if there might have been other avenues, it's not an abuse of discretion or otherwise anything that is reversible for the circuit court to say the dismissal was granted.
If the circuit court didn't follow HRPP Rule 8C2, isn't that an abuse of discretion, disregarding rules of principles of law?
If it was disregarded, but I don't believe that that is a disregard. I don't believe that the Rule 8 states what must or mustn't happen. I think Rule 8 is targeting, again, if the charges are brought in a legal fashion, these are the rules that govern. If they're not charged in a legal fashion, then
specifically speaks to failure to join related offenses.
Right. So, I mean, again, failure to join legal offenses.
Related offenses. So if the prosecution fails to join the related offenses, wouldn't this govern how the court looks at it, that failure?
if it says failure to join, then I think it would. I think I'm required to say that it would govern failure to join, right? So I guess I agree on that premise.
Thank you.
I don't know if there's any other questions. That's really what I wanted to talk about. I do think that in this case, the single episode is quite clear. And I think it's clear based on the linear nature of how each action led to the next action. I don't think that it is fair to, in a factual sense, eliminate the middle portion or whatever of what happened and just say, well, we'll just ignore that. I think that that's perfectly fine under the right circumstances at a trial, but we're not talking about trial. We're talking about what needs to happen before the judge can even determine what should happen at a trial. And when, in a case like this, when it's brought in two separate courtrooms, it makes it a lot harder to do that because we have two judges who, by and large, may not realize that there are other related offenses.
But in this case, they did.
Well, the circuit court did. It's unclear what the family court knew, right?
Well, wasn't the case continued multiple times on the defense's request because they were trying to reach a global settlement with both cases?
That's true, but a global resolution is pretty common for many defendants who have multiple cases, and I think most of the time they're not related.
The court said something about, hey, you have the other case in courtroom 3 or something like to that effect.
No.
It sounds like family court was aware.
Well, the family court was certainly aware that there was another case, but whether the family court was aware and to the extent that the two cases were stemmed from what I'm calling the same episode, I think that's a lot less clear on this record, what the family court knew in terms of the facts of the circuit court case. The family court knew there was a circuit court case, but for all we know, the circuit court case could have been completely different time, everything unrelated, completely unrelated, right? We don't know. So I don't think there's any advantage to bringing them separately. I think that there definitely is an advantage to bringing them together. I mean, aside from just compliance with the law, if it's all in front of one court, the judge can make the determination of what the best outcome is. If it's multiple judges that have maybe some of the picture, maybe all of the picture, even if they have all of the picture, they may come to different conclusions as to what's appropriate. Or maybe they don't want to because they don't want to make any conclusions because they don't want to run the risk of not agreeing with the other judge. They don't want to step on each other's toes or things like that. I think it was Kelly Heleua, right? That was the negligent injury insurance fraud car case. I think it was two separate agencies brought the charges. So even though they were pretty close in time, the fact that two separate agencies take it, I think one, obviously under 109, if they don't know about each other, then that's a problem. But it doesn't do anything for either the defendant's lack of uncertainty or lack of being harassed, or it doesn't do anything for the courts for judicial economy when the cases are brought separately and sort of.
Didn't the Supreme Court in that case say it was okay?
No, they did. But I think that was largely due to the fact that it was, again, two agencies. There's no evidence that the prosecuting attorneys knew of all of it all at once, right? There was reference to that issue. I think they also did indicate that they still thought it was maybe one episode anyway, but they did focus on the separate agencies, separate and apart from. Well, in a way that's not related to our case.
I think in that case, I mean, the court looked at probable cause, right, but also said that the negligent injury charge could be tried without mention of the fraud charge, so that even if the charges arose out of the same single incident, the motor vehicle accident, they not same episode.
Yeah, I do think that is part of it. I do think that is correct. And I think that's largely correct, that at the very least, the traffic incident happened and was concluded before somebody tries to go get insurance after the fact. So I do think that that's correct in that sense. I mean, I think that's a little different from our case, if that's what the suggestion is. I mean, for one,
how is it different?
It's a good question, but I think the main reason that I would say is because the police only found out about the abuse cases in the single investigation for everything, right? And so it's all in the same reports, and it was only reported to the police. Vegas did not report after either of the abuse incidents that these abuse incidents happened, right? She only reported when the police came in response to the terroristic threatening call. And so, I think legally that's an issue. And I think even at trial, I think realistically in a domestic violence type of case, the manner and timing and all the circumstances surrounding late reporting is always going to be a factor. It's always going to be something that the state addresses.
That's not necessary though to charge in charging or proving the firearms charges.
It's not strictly right. Legally. Oh, wait, as to the firearms charges.
Correct. I mean, so whether or not the abuse, there's a factual overlap between the abuse charges and the terroristic threatening, it seems to me, and this just circles back to what we had discussed earlier, that the firearms, the place to keep at least, seem separate.
So I think they do in some, you could say they seem separate, but I do think that, again, the question for the firearms is, how did we get here? What led us to this point? What are the immediate things? And if we look at it from an approximate cause, I don't think you can say that any of the abuse incidents or anything in the intervening is anything but proximately causing what happened. So
thank you.
My time.
Judge McCollum, anything else?
Actually, real quick. So part of Section 2 also, and sorry to go back to this, but part of Section 2 also says that if such offenses are known to the appropriate prosecuting officer at the time of the commencement of the first trial. And so again, there's the insertion of trial and the a first trial never commenced and because he pled out. Again, I'm trying to still figure out how we fall under subsection 2. Is that significant, commencement of the first trial?
I mean, I think for it to be significant, to try to really quickly answer, for it to be significant, there have to be some distinction in the rule between trial or other types of resolution. I'm not aware of anywhere in the rule that talks about the distinction between those. So even if it's inelegantly phrased to say a trial.
But there is case law on when a trial is commenced, right?
Sure. But I mean, again, I don't know why we would conclude that means trial and as the only possible resolution when any of this matters. Maybe it's in there. Like I said, I haven't spent the time reviewing this. But my instinct is that that's not what was intended or what logically would flow from that rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You good? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
To address some of the topics that were raised, first about the facts. So we're in terms of the terroristic threatening, reckless, endangering. So defendant threatened complainant and told her he was coming with a loaded rifle. He did that, we argue, because she and the kids were missing. He thought she was going to leave him. Why the legitimacy of why complainant left is not relevant. That would mean the abuses is why she left. So we argue that is not relevant to the picture of the of what defendant did on this day in the underlying case. Then we look at the analysis for sub-element B, whether they arise from the same episode. And that sub-element talks about whether a complete account of one charge cannot be related without referring to details of the other charge. We did that at grand jury. We did not bring up the abuse offenses, and the case was found by the grand jury to have probable cause and got charged that way. Sardinia shows us that we look at the prosecution's perspective of putting on its case in terms of whether it can be a complete accounting, not whether the defendant is going to raise other details about other incidences. That was totally rejected in Sardinia.
Right, but in Sardinia, it doesn't look at all like the same episode, right? We have the traffic offense where he's out on the road, and then later at the restaurant, he's getting arrested on a warrant or a possible warrant, and he head bumped the cops. Clearly, what happened on the road, there was a factual basis in the record for saying clearly that was different than head bumping the cop at the restaurant or the police officer. Excuse me.
First of all, the elements of terroristic threatening are not the same as the abuses. The conduct element is not the same, that's lessory. Again, defendant's anger doesn't make it the same episode. And what I've just stated of the legitimacy of complainant leaving the house and making him so angry, the legitimacy of complainant's reason has no bearing on what defendant did. Also, we look at, I think Justice McCullen was concerned about HRPP 8, and I wanted to point out in that subsection A, the phrasing of that rule is different. It talks about same or similar character, and it talks about a single scheme or plan. So it's different wording from the HRS 701-109 subparent 2. Being that this motion was brought under the statute, we argue that HRPP 8 is not the issue in this case because the trial court did not rule on it. And why should we be bringing in issues that were not raised in the trial court? Also, in terms of the timing of time for trial, that was another issue. While we look at this case, the underlying case was went to AMP February 11, 2021. There were 9 pretrials. It got continued, that was pointed out by the court, for a global settlement. It was at the 9th pretrial on March 15, 2022, almost a year later, that defendant gets up and says, I'm going to plead no contest as charged in the abuse. The state had no notice that this was going to happen, so of course we couldn't join the cases for trial. We arguably would have had more opportunity had he said, we're going to set this for trial. So there was a lot of strategy going on defense part, and we were led to believe that there was going to be a global summit, but lo and behold, no. He had a great strategy, and he pled no contest and then brought this motion to dismiss. So again, we go back to Sardinia. They considered a no contest plea to one incident, but yet found that it was not the same incident for the second incident, for the second happening involving the headbutting of the officer. In terms of the findings of fact, conclusion of law 10, which we did contest, reflects the trial court's erroneous focus on probable cause, not even a correct probable cause analysis. And that led to its conclusions being an error in 11, 13, and 14 that this was the same episode. It was not. And so we ask for the findings of fact, conclusions of law to be reversed and the underlying case to be reinstated. Thank you.
So wait, I have a question, as long as we're back to points of error. On the challenge to finding of fact 4, it seems like you're only arguing subparts G and H, and the challenge appears to be to the description or reference to the other findings therein, calling them the entire criminal episode. That's the challenge, right?
Yes.
Okay, just to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will take this case under advisement.
Eku iluna. All rise.